You're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards Tiekert. Speaking of Randy Shaw, his new book is Generation Priced Out, Who Gets to Live in the New Urban America? So there is this libertarian argument against inclusionary zoning, which is that it raises the cost of development. I went over the latest estimate from Mark Hogan. He's an architect who kind of annually for Spur puts together a back of the napkin estimate of what it costs to build one unit of housing in San Francisco. He currently pegs the cost before profit at $714,000.
Yeah, that's what I've heard. That's for an affordable unit is what I've heard.
For any unit.
Oh, that's a little high for any unit, but anyway.
And, you know, he says for a market rate unit, about 87,000 of that is the cost of the inclusionary housing, either building inclusionary units or buying out of the obligation to do so. The argument is that on the margins, that keeps a lot of housing from getting built in the first place. What's your response?
Well, you know, I would say that I go into the inclusionary housing thing in Generation Priced Out and explain why studies have shown that it is the best way to go, and that obviously people are always saying, yes, but if you set the number too high, people won't build. That is true. That's true. But don't set it too high then. And I think that as I say, if you look at neighborhoods, affluent neighborhoods in every city, but take, no, I'm going to go back to Noe Valley, Bernal Heights. What is the progressive or left strategy for getting working people to live in those neighborhoods if you can never build apartments or you can never have inclusionary? I see no strategy, and that's why we don't have any working people left in those neighborhoods. New, younger people, they can't afford it. There might have been people who bought 30 years ago or 40 years ago, and they're still there, and they're not rich. But I think for some reason, we seem to find it acceptable to have all the new housing built in a few neighborhoods in San Francisco and leave the rest of the city off. And inclusionary, the reason I'm so into inclusionary is that if you could build a 12-unit building or 20-unit building in Noe Valley, then you could have, you know, 4 units that are affordable. I talk in the unit about how there are some, that's the only way people can get access. And people say, well, that's only 20%. It's not very much, but it's 20% is more than zero. Mm-hmm. And otherwise you're consigning, I mean, it's great that we have a lot of nonprofit housing in the Tenderloin, but a lot of families would rather live in another neighborhood. They'd like a better, you know, Noe Valley has a lot of opportunities the Tenderloin doesn't have. So if we're going to be serious about not segregating the poor in certain neighborhoods, not segregating people by race, inclusionary is an essential, I think it's an essential policy. And it's one of the ones I think is critical for affordability.
It seems so profoundly limited when in the city with the highest valued land in the country, San Francisco, the most you can wring out of developers is 20%. A city where only 20% of the residents are not millionaires is not a city that's particularly fun to live in.
Well, keep in mind, there's a whole bunch of subsidized housing on top of it. So We're talking about, and I think a really important point to make is that, and for the readers to listeners to understand, is that most renters in the United States are suffering from economic affordable price crisis because they're entitled to federal relief and federal subsidies, and they're not getting it. 75% of eligible households aren't getting it. So my book is not about the
because
people.
Because there's simply not enough money flowing out of HUD to
right.
the
Section
the budget,
8 program. Right. My day-to-day work is housing homeless people, but my book is not about people who need federal subsidies in order to live in these cities. My argument in my book is that teachers, nurses, firefighters, used to always unionized janitors and hotel workers, they used to always be able to live in San Francisco and all the cities I mentioned, and now they can't. And I'm trying to focus on getting them back in, and inclusionary is one way to get them back in. Obviously, people always look at the numbers of how many units are created, and they say it's a small number. You're right. And I think one of the major themes of Generation Priced Out is there's no one solution. You have to have rent control, tenant protections, preserve rental housing, build more housing of all income levels. You have to do all of these things because no one solution is, there's no magic bullet.
So some of the solutions you profile, you lift up groups in the mission that actually either opposed new development or used their leverage in blocking new development to extract concessions from developers above and beyond what was required
right.
by law.
You know, as I say in the book, Personally, I prefer to work out deals with developers in the 10-to-1 where it's an amicable thing. If it's not possible in the mission, they've used a confrontational approach to great success. I mean, just on November 14th, there was a big ceremony about a project that Mission Housing is doing with Bridge Housing at 490 South Van Ness. Well, that was an approved condo project that Mayor Lee spent $19 million to acquire. Why did Mayor Lee spend $19 million to acquire? Because it was a housing bond and there was a lot of concern about the mission and development. And activists made it clear that the mission needed help. So that was like a thing he did for the mission. $50 million of the bond went to the mission. You got to give the activists of the mission tremendous credit for their confrontational approach. I know developers don't like it, but bottom line, it's successful. And I should just mention, I talk in the book about Boyle Heights and the whole thing where tenant activists did a very aggressive and confrontational approach toward fighting off what they saw as impending gentrification there. The LA Times even editorialized against the activists, but the reality is it's working. And you have to use a by all means necessary approach sometimes when you're really trying to keep low-income people in their homes.
So the extreme version of this strategy, I think we could point at the movement to get a moratorium on new development in the mission circa 2015. And the argument that then-Supervisor David Campos put to us when we debated it on air was, look, there are only so many buildable lots in my district. The way the market's moving now, the speed with which investors and developers are moving, they will all be built out with for-profit, meaning high-income housing, before an affordable housing developer can even get their foot in the door.
Well, I mean, the moratorium lost in almost every neighborhood because it raised some all kinds of issues about people who'd acquired land and now we're told they can't build. Mm-hmm. But I think that, as I said, when the moratorium was on the ballot, the city was under pressure, felt pressured to give more money to the mission. And I think it may surprise many of your listeners that, and I have this in the book, if you look at statistics, the decline in the Latino population has actually ebbed. And Latino population is stabilized in the mission because of all these things that have happened. But we can't ignore the fact, and I'm not going to mention names of who supervisors were, but 10 years went by, 2003 to 2013. Why didn't David Campos, who was elected in 2010, why didn't he make sure money was given to acquire sites? No one was stopped. The sites could have been acquired in the mission, but the nonprofit sector and Mission Housing was defunded all that time. And what they should have done is fine. You don't want Mission Housing to build, create a new nonprofit and have them build. That never happened. So everybody was watching as the mission nonprofit sector and activists weren't acquiring sites. Now they're on board. We also have a small sites program, which is really heavily targeted to the mission that Mayor Lee started, which stops Ellis evictions and buys small buildings. So I think that I wish they'd done this in 2003, but better late than never. So I think the mission is really proving to be a surprising success and that in what's going on is due to the strong activism there.
But it gets to a bigger issue, which is one of the YIMBY catchphrases is build more of all types of housing. But surely there are circumstances under which for-profit developers are competing with nonprofit affordable housing developers for land or for construction labor in really tight markets like you have in San Francisco now. And the upward pressure they're putting on prices for sites and for construction contractors are making it harder to get affordable housing built.
Well, I know that's a popular view. I'm sorry I have to disagree with you, Brian, because if you look at where
upscale
housing and built around the downtown area, that nonprofits had never built in that area anyway. And where you see a lot of the market rate housing, nonprofits are building in Mission Bay because sites were guaranteed to them. So, and the mission has tons of nonprofit sites available right now. So I think that's a theory that's not based on fact. And there's areas we can, I mean, the Tenderloin, we have, you know, so many nonprofit sites that are going on. And I think that's a theory. And I think that there's no question that in many of the cities I write about, that is a huge problem. And I know we're just talking about San Francisco, but I think one of the most important messages in my book is that we have to use public land for affordable housing. And I talk about how Mayor de Blasio of New York, who's turned out to be an absolute disaster with the Amazon deal, is just the tip of the iceberg. He's a disaster on housing. There was an armory, and he wanted to make it luxury condos. We have to look at all of our public land in San Francisco and use all of it, if we can, for affordable housing, precisely because then nonprofits save the money of acquisition, because that's the big savings, not have to pay. Land's gotten so expensive in this market. But if it's a public site, let's convert it to housing. And we got to do more of that in every city.
The other big left critique of the Build Baby Build attitude is that when what the market is building is housing for extremely high-income individuals, which is what the market builds for in San Francisco, is going to build for your highest profit margin, that has neighborhood-level effects. There's induced demand. Rich people spend a lot of money locally. That's going to create more low-paid jobs in retail and the service sector, and those people are going to need some place to live. And there's also the question of kind of institutional gentrification. Having higher-income consumers in a neighborhood is going to raise commercial rents, and then the bodegas and the grocery stores that served a working-class population are going to be priced out. Even if the people get to stay there, the institutions that they rely on are going to be gone.
Well, it's a curious argument why the progressive supervisors in San Francisco have supported every downtown high-rise development of the richest people in the entire city. That's where they're living. They're not living in the Tenderloin. They're not living in the West Side. They're living in the downtown SoMa area, which all those projects have been approved. So we got to get our argument straight. If we don't want wealthy people coming in because they're going to be going out and influencing the overall city, then we shouldn't have approved Rincon and Millennium. We shouldn't have approved the 5M project. You know, I'm just saying, let's be consistent. I get the point.
But I think if you are concerned with neighborhood level impacts, then they don't apply if you're dropping a tower into the downtown area the same way they do apply if you're having a big development in the middle of the Mission.
You know, again, so much of what we're talking about, and that's why I do have a section in the book about the Mission for this reason. I mean, it's like, the whole talk about San Francisco gentrification acts like the only neighborhood we have in San Francisco is the Mission. There's vast stretches of the city, very little gets built. And we don't even talk about it. And
to your earlier point about the west side of San Francisco.
So here's the thing. Nothing is getting built in Noe Valley, the Castro, or Noe Valley, you know, the inner Richmond. And those prices are going through the roof. But no one is saying, wait a minute now, because we're not building, only the rich can live in Noe Valley and Bernal Heights. Check Bernal Heights housing costs. Check Potrero Hill and what they've done. So why aren't we alarmed about the lack of building is causing prices to escalate? That's a fact. But we only look at one side and not the other. Who can buy it when the working class homeowner who bought in 1965 dies and the house goes for sale in Noe Valley? It's going to be $2 million or more. And a wealthy person is going to move in.
Right, but what about
that? And what I'm saying, doesn't that have an impact on Noe Valley when it's all rich people? Mm-hmm. Whereas when you build, like with the Liverick Lofts, they were selling it for $200,000, you build a fourplex, the people aren't going to be as rich as having to afford the $2 million home. Mm-hmm. So that's why I think allowing apartments in all these neighborhoods would make us less dominated by affluent residents.
Yeah. But what's your specific response to the induced demand argument? I mean, this is actually in a city economist's analysis to justify the city's inclusionary housing fee, saying basically for every new market rate unit, 0.4 new jobs are created and we have to house those people.
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, we've been creating jobs without any regard for housing. We're still doing it. We just passed a Central SoMa plan in San Francisco where there's an unbelievable imbalance. I mean, a crazy imbalance. And it just guarantees. And that was, again, the
by imbalance, you mean a lot more offices than housing for the people
right.
who
and
work
so,
in them.
So that if we want to be consistent, we shouldn't have supported that plan, right? Because if you believe that you don't want to bring all these office workers, you're going to put pressure on our local housing market and affect – then we shouldn't have approved that. I want to make another important point, though, that I think we should really, when we talk about San Francisco, is we act sometimes like every neighborhood isn't gentrified, and the Tenderloin is not, but considering there's hardly any place you can buy a house for under $1 million, any house, we're not talking about low-income people when they're trying to buy. The status quo isn't working. So all these neighborhoods where nothing gets built, none of the projects we're talking about, none of the millennial towers, Rinca, they're incredibly unaffordable. And I think sometimes we don't look carefully enough at how this not building and what the prices are. We assume that is the reason that things are so expensive in on the West Side because we're building downtown high rises.
Yeah. The backstory, you touched on it earlier in the interview, you touched on it in the book, although it's not a central exploration of the book, is that over the period you're writing about, there's also just been a massive retreat by the federal government from first paying for the construction of public housing, and then even paying for the vouchers that were to subsidize tenants living in private housing. I mean, how much of the housing crisis that we're dealing to is a consequence of shifts in federal policy that's outside the control of local policymakers?
Well, the homeless crisis is 100% due to the cuts in federal policy. Had we not gone out of the public housing business in the 70s and then Reagan not killed the HUD budget, which we've never recovered for in his 1981 budget, it's 100% caused by that. We didn't have a homeless problem in the 1960s. People were still taking drugs and engaging in drinking and having those things, but we had no homeless problem because they could afford places to live. Because when you have, there's not another country, industrial country in the world where 75% of eligible assistance for federal aid don't get it. I mean, it's terrible. And unfortunately, you know, since the homeless crisis began, we've had two Democratic presidents, and they haven't made a meaningful difference. I'm not saying that Obama's HUD, Clinton's HUD until the last couple of years was a disaster, and Obama made progress, but it was so incremental. I mean, look where we are now. But we've never had the Marshall Plan to deal with the nation's homeless. That's why we're very happy Prop C passed and Mark Benioff came in and articulated what the problem has been. We've never had the money in San Francisco to deal with it, and this will make a big difference once it's implemented. So, but in terms of just subsidized housing, all these families living, you know, priced out of the city, they used to have be able to have Section 8, or if we had more public housing. I mean, we got out of the I see all these things on Twitter. Everyone's into we want to have social housing. I hope folks realize the U.S. got out of it in the 70s, got out of the business
of building it.
And obviously, that's the most affordable way to do it. If the government builds the housing, the rents are the lowest. You're not subsidizing a private landlord at market rents like you are at Section 8.
Right. So, like, if you had a magic wand, like, what would be the right balance of public financing for affordable housing versus market rate construction? How much money would the housing ecosystem in San Francisco need coming from the public sector to support a healthy
city?
Well,
I mean, it would be in the billions of dollars. I mean, San Francisco, again, it's not typical. L.A., it could be very easy to do because you have the land. Mm-hmm. You know, San Francisco, it said you could build 150,000 more units. The land is there, and it probably is if you do rezoning and everything. But so many other cities in this country that have, like L.A., which has vast stretches of land that's, you know, got a 30-foot height limit. You know, so like you look at these one-story strip malls, they could build so many apartments and really solve. They have the worst, LA has the worst homeless crisis and one of the worst housing crises. But San Francisco, even with that, we could make a big difference. Like I say, you know, people say to me, well, you wrote this book, you know, how do you think you can make San Francisco affordable again? I say, well, look, San Francisco's not going to be affordable for everyone again. I mean, those days are gone. Even if you freeze rents for the next 5 years, they're at a very high level, right? But we still can do things to expand through affordability restrictions, inclusionary housing, building more housing, spread out the supply. And already, because we have built a little more housing, rents and home prices are stabilized compared to where they were. But obviously, we have a way to go. And we're still not, we're building like 5,000 units in our best year, mm-hmm. which is nowhere near what we should be building.
Yeah. Well, and San Francisco has this larger complication, which you reference in the book, but it's not what the book is about, which is that Silicon Valley has pursued this growth pattern where there's all these suburban cities that have greenlit massive corporate tech campuses without greenlighting any associated housing, you know, for the workforce. They've turned San Francisco into a bedroom community.
If I could turn back the clock on one housing policy thing, you know, now you're seeing YIMBYs and people going down to Cupertino and demanding that Apple build housing. You're mm-hmm. seeing that in 2018. San Francisco Housing Action Coalition and other groups have really organized a great job working with the local Cupertino folks. I wish we had done that in the dot-com boom in the 90s. We let all those tech companies open up in Silicon Valley, build no housing. Their workers ended up moving to Noe Valley because it's close, and Bernal Heights
and the Mission
and Potrero. The Mission, all those eastern neighborhoods that were close to freeway, close. And I don't recall anyone going down and saying, demanding housing being built. At least we could have tried. And it's working a little bit and helped organize. We should have been working in Silicon. Instead, we just kind of were focusing on the impacts as they were affecting us. And I have a lot in the book about the tenants that my office represented frequently. You know, Lola McKay, 50-year tenant, all those Ellis Act evictions and OMI, owner moving eviction horror stories that people are familiar with, began in the dot-com boom for the most part. And they've continued. And it's a connection to the Silicon Valley not building enough housing. And it's, I wish we could have dealt with that and forced them and pressure campaigned against them in the 90s. It would have made, maybe we would have had some success.
I mean, it seems like there's a profound mismatch between the level at which government operates and the level at which the housing market operates, because housing is a regional market. Local government in the Bay Area is split up among more than 100 entities, each of which answer to pretty parochial local interests.
Well, I think in the big picture, I mean, for years, San Francisco, like we said, and you have dot-com boom and no one is demanding these cities produce housing or these tech companies produce housing. And I think one thing the YIMBYs have done is change that argument. Now Amazon, everybody is saying about Queens, what the hell are you bringing Amazon in without any housing? They're just going to displace people. It's a disaster. And I write about it in the book. I write about Seattle in the book and how Amazon really affected housing prices. And I say in the book, there's a competition going on for Amazon's second Horta headquarters, and I don't wish good the loser better. Everyone better hope they don't get it, because mm-hmm. it's not a good result. And I think you're seeing real resistance now in New York City because they see how it's coming out. We need to be more aggressive, and that's like we need to be more aggressive. I write in the book about Austin. Austin lets a developer tear down a 244 unit apartment building housing low-income families. What is on that site now? An Oracle plant. Did Oracle have to build any housing? No. Was Oracle even asked by city government to build any housing or required to? No. So 244 families get evicted, and Oracle's there now. I mean, we have to stop. And this is in Austin, which is a quote-unquote progressive city. So we have to start demanding the corporations provide housing and that cities require it.
Well, Randy Shaw, it is an interesting book, and we have just about run the clock on our time to discuss it. I want to thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Randy Shaw is director of the Tenderloin Housing Clinic. His new book is Generation Priced Out, Who Gets to Live in the New Urban America?